Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a wonderful show for you this evening. Aviation educator and creator of the Finer Points app and podcast, Jason Miller, is here. And it's just going to be so much fun talking to him. I could talk to him for days, and you just learn so, so much. And I also am very, very excited that Social Flight Live has been unanimously selected by all of you as the opening act for tonight's presidential debate. So that is a prestigious honor. I appreciate that all of you have graced us with that. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, things are booming inside of Social Flight as we begin to slide into fall across the United States. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations happening. So many amazing things. Get on there and check out what's happening because we are dedicated to getting you flying more and giving you all destinations and missions. It is all free to you and brought to you by these folks that you see on the board behind me here, and please thank all of them for making so much of this possible. And we have so many other cool things in there as well. We've got the Fly to Win Challenge. Just get the mobile app for your Apple or Android device. You can check in at different airports when you fly, and that gives you points, and you can enter in to win all sorts of prizes. We just gave away an Aspen electronic flight display glass for your panel, and on October 1st, coming up quick, we are giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. That thing is truly amazing. So be sure to get in there, check it out. Even if you just check in at one airport, you are entered in to win. But if you fly to a bunch of airports, get on our leaderboard, you get extra entries to win. It's really just a fantastic way to help promote flying and general aviation as well. And we have on-demand education in our FAA Learning Center on Social Flight. That's WINGS courses you can take on your time for WINGS credit. If you're a mechanic, you can get AMT awards program credits. And if you're a mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can get your current training with legal FAA certificates directly through Social Flight. And lastly, we have our new podcast that also is happening. That's going to be back on Tuesday, October 8th. And that is Cockpit to Cowl, done with Brian Schiff and myself, where we take the perspective of instructor and mechanic and pilot, put it all together on a really fun show. So be sure to join us there. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Whip Air and their amazing Whip Line floats. And I have to tell you, as someone who has visited their location at South St. Paul Airport in Minnesota, please go check that out if you can. It is truly spectacular. The way they put together floats, especially for planes like Caravans, it's like watching an entire aircraft get built, and yet it's just the floats at the bottom. It's really amazing, and yet they do so, so much more there. They do avionics, paint, interior maintenance, you name it, and Whip Air is one of the reasons tonight's broadcast is here. Now, on to tonight's guest. Jason Miller is a CFII with more than 20 years of aviation experience and nearly 10,000 hours of instruction. As a member of the FAA safety team and an instructor for AOPA's Air Safety Institute, Jason has been awarded the Western Region's FAA CFI of the Year for numerous years. He is truly passionate about developing systems that help pilots fly safer and more efficiently, which led him to create this new approach to flight training and proficiency. I can tell you, as someone who is just now starting to get exposed to it, check it out and use it. It is truly spectacular, and not just good for people who are first getting their tickets, first doing their training. It is really, really great to keep you brushed up and keep you an active, proficient pilot. And so be sure to check that out as well. That's the TFP app, the Finer Points app for iPhones and iPads. Using his background as a performer and experience on the flight line, Jason created the Finer Points Aviation Podcast and that is now one of the most recognized and well-respected aviation podcasts in the world. I am thrilled to have him here with us tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Jason Miller. Hey. There you go.
Can you hear me there? How's that?
Loud and clear now. Hey, how are you doing tonight, Jason?
Good, Jeff. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for taking time to join us here on this really amazing kickoff to the debate show. It's pretty cool that we were selected for this, huh?
Yeah. It's a good gig. We're going to have to be concise here. We're going to have to get 1 hour and that's that, because I know everyone's going to run off and see the debate. So.
Okay, listen, I want to start. I've known you for quite a while. I've been a huge fan of your work. But even with all of that, I personally don't know enough about your background of how Jason Miller got to be Jason Miller. But I know there was a teaser in our opening about how you started as a performer. Tell me a little bit about how you got into aviation and what is the little teaser about you being a performer?
Yeah, that's funny. Well, you know, for me, I've never been one of those people that didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. I've always wanted to know. I mean, I've always known, and it's been just two things, music and flying, you know. So as a young kid, there's no pilots in my family, really. I was kind of the first one. My mother was a flight attendant for American, but she had retired before I was born, and my dad took some lessons, but it never seemed like flying was possible. So music was where I started. I went to college as a music major. In my high school, I was voted most musical, I think, as a senior in high school. And in any case, in my college years, just sort of floundering a bit, I started out as a music major, ended up a philosophy major, and started a band that really took off. This was in like 1991, 92, in that time frame. And the band really did well. And fortunately, our drummer was a lot older than we were, and he got our act together. We formed a corporation, and we ran it like a tight little business. We made a record. We had a record deal. We were on tour. You know, we were playing.
What was the name of the band? You can't
leave. The name of the band was Citrus, like the fruit, C-I-T-R-U-S. We were like part of the early jam band scene in the 90s in Chicago, which had a great music scene, like Smashing Pumpkins was coming out of there, like lots of Urge Overkill. Lots of good music coming out of Chicago always. And that was my gig. But, you know, as a musician on the road, you have hours and hours of downtime. You know, it's like that the moment of the show is like a small portion of your day. And you don't know anybody except the band. So I just read a lot. And at the time, I had to mail order flying books. So I mail ordered one called Private Pilot Single Engine Land by some woman. I don't even know if you can find it anymore. It was the Iowa State curriculum for the private pilot. And I started there, and I just went, I ended up with the FAA books, but that was the joke in the band. Everyone would laugh at me because I would just sit there on tour and read flying flight training handbooks and stuff like that. And eventually the band broke up. This was a few years later, 96. And this was an interesting time because we had shows booked out for a year. And the shows, as you know, like in a rock club, like they end at like 2 or 3 in the morning. But I knew that I was going to be a pilot at this point because the band was over. I knew we were done. We were just running out our 12 months of commitments. So I went to the airport. I went to Palwaukee Airport, which is Chicago Executive now, and I got a job working line service. I didn't know anything about anything. You know, I just knocked on the door and said, "Can I work? Can I work here?" And they, you know, said, "Sure, you can drive the fuel truck." But my shift started at 6 a.m., right? So for this year, there were many, many nights where I would finish putting my gear away at 4 in the morning, you know, after a show, and I would drive straight to the airport, change into my uniform, and fall asleep on the bench for an hour before the third shift guys woke me up on their way out the door. But that's sort of how I made that pivot. And, you know, there's a funny joke, like in music, when you get into music, everybody says you have to have a fallback plan. And I thought it was deeply humorous that when I got into flying, I was meeting. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't the aviation industry of today. It was 97. So yeah. It was the route, right? And everyone thought you were crazy for getting into it. And so what everyone kept telling me when I got into it is, "Oh, man, you're going to be a pilot? You better have a fallback." And my joke was, "Well, I got one. That's music, you know." So I tell all my musician friends my fallback is flying. All my flying friends, my fallback was music. So
That's really funny. Did you have people in your family that were pilots? Do you have any connection to it beforehand? So this was just a gut desire to get into aviation.
Well, I mean, you know how it is for us. Like, you know, those of us that have it, like, you know, you're probably going to find your way into it one way or another. But it started earlier than that. Like, when I was 14 years old, we moved to a different house in my town that was on the final approach path to runway. Gosh, must have been runway 15 at DuPage Airport, if there's a 15 there, something like that. And, you know, planes flying over my house, and I just followed them. Like, I mean, you know, a kid in the country on a Saturday, I had nothing to do. They looked low enough, and I was like, be home for dinner, Mom. Just followed the airplanes, and I found out that a 3-mile final looks a lot closer when you're in an airplane than it does when you're on the ground, because it took me a good part of the day to find my way to DuPage Airport. And but then I knew the way, and I would hang out there on the weekends, and, you know, you meet, there's still these kind of, you know, I don't know what to call them, like mythical figures in my head. You know, it's like a Richard Bach novel. I met a guy named Chuck one day who was a former FedEx pilot who showed me what a sectional was. And I met another guy who let me sit in his 210. Another guy let me use the simulator. And, you know how it is. You just, people get to know you and they help you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things I think is fascinating is that we, I think as a society, as a group, as an aviation industry, have such a short memory. We forget that back then, the idea, aviation, the biggest thing, if you read all the magazines, if you were looking at what the talk of the day was in the, you know, 90s and the early 2000s, it was, is general aviation dying?
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen? How are we going to replace the next generation because people aren't interested in it? That's what was happening back then. That's literally why we created Social Flight 15 years ago, was because how can we get people engaged in flying, because they weren't, and people were selling their airplanes and it didn't look like another generation was coming through. And here we are, and it couldn't be more different. And no one remembers that.
I know. It's funny. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Is like, I can't really relate to people that are sniffing this industry out. It's a Achilles heel of mine. Like, when people ask me today, like, you know, is this a good time to get into flying? I'm either going to be a lawyer or a pilot. Is this a good opportunity for me to get into it? And we really don't have a common language. You know, it's like, get into it if you love to do it or you want to do it. But if you don't, you know. And in general, I think that's, for better or for worse, the way I live my life, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, musician or being a pilot, like, that historically was, you need to do this because you love it. You
know? Yeah.
Acting, music, pilot, this is something you do out of this is what you are. This is how you're going to do it, no matter how rough it's going to be.
Yeah, 100%. And and even then, you know, it's like, here I am as a flight instructor in the industry, which is kind of a strange thing to say. You know, you've been that's where really my career is and where my career has stayed and continues to exist for whatever it is now, 22 years.
Mm. You know? So tell me a little bit about that. How did you go from then getting your ticket? What was your path like to then becoming a flight instructor and finding that this is your calling? And then after that, we'll talk about kind of how you created the finer points.
Yeah, sure. And this is it's a good segue to some of the stuff you and I were chatting about a while back. But it's like, when I moved to California, I met a different caliber of flight instructor. So the way it worked for me, how did I end up here? I was going to Embry-Riddle. I was enrolled after the band. I thought, well, I never finished college. I'll go to Embry-Riddle. I'll finish my degree and I'll be an airline pilot and just get on board like everybody else. And when I got my private, something sort of snapped in me where I wasn't sure I wanted to be an airline pilot. And this is where, by the way, I think the line service job was so important for me, because at Priester Aviation, where I worked, our entire Gulfstream One flight department was manned or like staffed by old Eastern airline pilots, right? You've never met a bitter pilot until you've met like a 52-year-old Eastern airline pilot, right? I mean, these guys were like, you know, like, kid, you don't know what you're doing. Like, this is stupid. You're a moron for getting into this. Go back to music. You got a better chance. You know, I mean, it was like all these guys were left high and dry, you know, and like late in their lives. So I was aware that it wasn't a guarantee, you know, even if you get in with an airline. I learned pretty early on how it works. You you get a seniority number. The number's tied to the airline. If the airline goes under, you're in the, you know, you go to the back of the line somewhere else. So I, you know, I, as I started to learn this stuff, I got my private and I realized I better call off Embry-Riddle. It was like 2 weeks away from time for me to show up there. And my bandmate from Chicago had moved to California and said, hey, I have a room for rent. And so I moved to the Bay Area. That was just randomly how I ended up there. But when I got there, I realized that in the Bay Area, and I still believe this, it's a perfect storm for flight training, or at least in the years that I've been there. Maybe pre-tech, that might not have been as true, but since the tech industry has exploded, you've got an abundance of young male engineer types with cash in their pocket and time on their hands and weather that's flyable 365 days a year. It's like, it's a perfect storm for flight training. So people go there and they teach for their whole lives. Like, you know, it might sound strange that I'm a 22-year veteran career flight instructor, but I could give you two dozen names of people that you don't know because they don't have a podcast and a YouTube channel that are in the Bay Area doing the same thing, you know? And so when I got there, I met my mentor, Richard, and I realized, you know, on paper, I hired him for my instrument rating, but he was kind of sadistic and honest, and he was an old Air Force guy. And, you know, he used to give me a lot of crap about it, kind of like, you know, like, I can't teach you how to fly instruments. You don't know how to fly the plane. You know, this kind of stuff, right?
A little wax on.
Yeah, right? And because all my friends were on the fast track to the airlines, none of them had time or patience to deal with an old guy like that. But I was kind of loving it. I didn't really know what I was going to do with flying. I was living on my sailboat after I moved out of my that's kind of a long story, but after I moved out of my guitar player's house, I rented a boat and I lived in the marina during flight training to keep the costs down. And I love those years. Speaking of cash in your pocket, I could, you know, I was living on a boat, I was working two jobs, everything I had I spent on Richard, and I was flying, you know, 3-4 times a week, then renting planes. I mean, I just kind of dove into aviation and loved it. And I learned so much from him, and just him and Lou Fields and Mike Corklin, just all these folks that are my senior, whatever that was. I'm getting into this. This is like 1998 I'm describing, but the guys who were like teaching 85, 86, you know, through the 80s and the early 90s. Anyway, I just learned a lot from that generation, in particular from Richard. And so because I wasn't on a fast track to the airlines or anything, and I was truly just wanting to get good, I kind of had a sense looking at the market in the Bay Area that I could teach forever and be just fine with that. You know, and you see it. You see examples of it all around you. I'm sure there are other markets like it in the United States, but there aren't that many. You know, right. You can do it in Southern California, parts of Florida that I'm aware of, maybe Scottsdale these days. Anyway, you need a perfect storm of all the elements, the weather, the market, and the people that you know, want to do it and can afford to do it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I started to think I was going to teach for a while. And so by the time I got my CFI certificate in 2002, I was just like a racehorse coming out of the gate. I couldn't wait to teach my first lesson. I had my first lesson scheduled the day after my CFI check ride. That's how confident I was on the check ride.
Wow.
Yeah.
had you been, you know, a lot of people who really take to education in that way were natural teachers their whole life. Did you find that there was a bunch of corollaries early on in your life that you just said, this is what I do anyway? I mean, teaching is a form of performance, of course, but was there also something else that kind of brought you and made you so comfortable? Were you love teaching?
No, you know, I think that, I do love teaching. And as it turns out, I realize, after all this time that I really am a teacher through and through. That's what I love. And I love flying, but I only notice what you're talking about in retrospect. But I will say
that's
this.
Best way to know it.
Yeah, I guess. And these days I live in the foothills. So my family and I are up in Nevada City, and I go back to the Bay Area to do like one-off lessons and that kind of thing. But my actual students are here. And I'm not going to say anything disparaging about my current students. but I will say that the students that I've met and flew with in my time doing like exclusively in the San Francisco Bay Area are extraordinary people. Like, I got easily as much from them as they got from me over the years, and almost without fail, whether they were investors in tech companies or founders of companies or young kids looking to make a difference or just people that from all over the world that are working at Apple, Google, and Facebook, just the kind of people that I met, I really value. And even now I have other instructors will ask me questions like, you know, how do I motivate people or how do I get them to put up with my rigid standards or and all this sort of stuff. And I only now know what they're talking about because I live in a smaller place and the students are sometimes less motivated than others, but this is not a problem in Silicon Valley. Like, you know, you could just fire. I mean, there's so many people that want to fly. Like, there's no issue with, are you going to be at the lesson or, you know, are you motivated to really finish this or that kind of thing? Are you going to start and then stall out? That's very uncommon. You know, it's a lot of type A personalities that if they start it, they finish it, they want to do it to the 10th power, not the second power. That kind of thing.
I think there's a general tendency always to look back at the glory days, to say things are different now, things have changed. How much do you believe we have a very real change of what's happening now to, let's say, back in the early 90s when we were learning how to fly and things like that? And the reason I ask, the specific thing I'm asking about is I seem to remember it was almost the norm to have people that were far more experienced that did it part-time. I mean, my primary flight instructor was a guy who his day job was being a state trooper. And he was an amazing primary flight instructor. Just had this steely confidence in this way to let me get to the very edge of screwing up. I mean, I knew exactly how far to go down the runway when the plane wouldn't lift off, going like, so you're going to lift up the flaps? Whatever. Like, you know, versus now where the industry always talks about we're just churning through CFIs. What's happening?
Well, I think to some extent that's cyclical. You know, like the short answer to your question is that there's two things that jump to my mind. I mean, one is FAA cycles, how the FAA interprets the training standards and how that changes on a kind of long, long phase, you know, like very long wavelength. And then there's the cyclical like market, like when the airlines are sucking CFIs up, none of them stay very long and they're all gone. And then there's periods of drought where the CFIs will hover in that position for say 3-4 years before they can move on. And I think those are two separate cycles, but I think that's part of it. If you look at, like it shocks me sometimes. If you go back and look at the airman statistics from like 1980, I think it was 980 or maybe 990,000 active pilots, right? Mm-hmm. Just rounded off to 1 million pilots. Today, I think we have somewhere just north of 200,000. So can you imagine what it would feel like if this industry was more than four times the size it is right now, the number of pilots that are flying? And the problem, you know, I feel like in some ways, I don't want to sound like the old guy in the room, but I'm the old guy in the room, and that's just the way it is, you know? But it's like what happened in the 80s was there were so many pilots, they were doing ridiculous things. Kind of like what you're saying is like, where's all the experience? Or, you know, they're crashing and, you know, it was so egregious that it brought the whole industry to a grinding halt. And I think it was 86 where Cessna was like, we're out, we're not making planes anymore. There's too much liability. And it brought the entire party to a grinding halt. Like someone just, you know, just stopped the record machine. And so when I came into it in 97, it was like the drought years. And if you were a CFI and you decided to stay with it after 86, you meant it. Like you were somebody that, you know, you can't pry me off this airplane. You know, you're the Lou Fields, you know, and, you know, Lou had a trailer out at Oakland Airport. He was an old Navy Corsair instructor in the late 50s and 60s, I think. But he had a trailer out at Oakland. He had a Pitts S1, I think, and a Citabria. And an old sign that said, you know, old Navy flight instructor. And that was, you know, like if Lou didn't care whether or not it was a popular time to learn to fly or if it wasn't a popular time to learn to fly, it's who he was through and through. And so I feel like when there's that cycle, right? And then also the same thing when the CFIs get sucked up to the airlines, they don't have a chance. Even if they wanted to sit there for that long, they don't have a chance to sit there for that long. Mm. So that's one thing. And then the FAA, of course, follows those cycles also. Like, this is it's just interesting to watch. You know, I recently did a YouTube video on this whole teardrop into the pattern is an example of that. I'm pretty sure that if we all just hang in there another 5 years, this will be a non-issue in the rearview mirror. Nobody will be calling it a teardrop. It'll be a 45-degree entry, and all the pictures will be updated. But then 10 years after that, somebody might say, hey, it'd be a good idea to do a teardrop, and here it comes back again, you know?
Definitely going to talk about that in a minute, but yeah.
Yeah, like on my private pilot check ride, for example, I had to demonstrate minimum controllable airspeed, which is like basically hanging on the prop, right? And that was something I had to learn and something I had to demonstrate in 1998 when I went for my private check ride. Well, where we are today with the ACS is that we don't do minimum controllable airspeed anymore. In fact, now we want slow flight, but if they so much as hear the stall horn, it's a fail. So we don't want the students so slow that they hear the stall horn. So
really,
they're not bringing them anywhere near that edge of the envelope, right? And that's been that way for quite a good number of years now. However, they just added this new maneuver into the CFI ACS, which is taking us back in the direction of minimum controllable airspeed. And that's what I mean by there are cycles to the FAA. There are people that spend their lives there arguing for a certain thing, and then eventually they go away and the accident data suggests what it does, and somebody else brings in a new idea and it kind of follows its own cycle.
That's really fascinating. I love that view of it, because that isn't something I've really thought about before, and yet, as you pointed out, it makes perfect sense and it matches up extremely well. Of course, there's many, many other factors, because yes, when I think back at that, on the whatever I want to call it, you know, the glory days when you and I learned how to fly. That I feel like the expertise in the people teaching us and in general, and a lot of people that were other pilots at the time, was different and certainly had more expertise than now, but there was less enforcement and there were higher accident rates and lower safety technology, like all sorts of stuff. That said, I when I think back on my original training, I think back on not just maneuvers like show me slow flight, show me stalls, show me these things. I just remember my instructor, John McCory, taking me into tough situations. They weren't tough. I thought they were tough. And sitting there and going like, yeah, I'm going to have you actually take off from a short field.
Yeah.
I'm going to have you. He would bring me over an airport and say, I want, you know, you're now whatever, we'd be on base basically at a high altitude or close to the runway. I want you to land.
Yeah.
And it was like, I don't think I can do that. He's like, yeah, you actually can.
Yeah.
And he's going to show me. And that means instead of just demonstrating things, using slow flight to land, using techniques. Tell me a little bit about how that fits, because I worry that's a lost art.
Well, it just reeks to me of somebody who's really comfortable in the airplane. You know, somebody who spends a lot of time in the airplane, somebody who has butt time in the seat, who's confident teaching those edges of the envelope, you know. Even if you're doing a lot of airline flying, doesn't mean you're comfortable in a light airplane exactly. You know, those are two sort of separate skills you have to maintain. And I've run into this with our airplane camp trips that we run, where I'll think of a pilot in my mind who's like, you know, so experienced. We used to fly together, you know, 7 years ago, and they've got so much time and they've been flying for Delta or whatever. And I finally could reach them and they're like, man, I haven't flown a light plane in 6 years. Like that's not, or, you know,
right.
So, or I only fly the light plane, once a month, you know, with a guy that I only charge $40 an hour because I'm really busy and I don't, you know, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like not really engaged with it or with him. So when you describe the CFI that you're mentioning to me, that's a CFI that's working regularly, that's comfortable in the airplane, that has done it so many times that they know, like, you know, it's not all that hard to figure out a training airplane, really. Like, it's a pretty forgiving environment if you've got enough hours in it, you know? And yeah. So it's important, I think, for CFIs to, you know, A, show people the edges in the envelope, but also B, kind of fold their arms a little bit and say, what are you going to do about that, Jeff? You know, and that takes like a certain amount of confidence.
Do you think that we can, I mean, I guess the question is there value to it and what can we do to get it back? And I want to be really, really clear to everyone listening when we use a term like edges of the envelope, I don't think that this was the perception of a student, right? Of a primary student. I don't think we were ever near an edge of an envelope. I just think we were farther than I think people usually do things today. I think it's just like they were teaching to, you know, areas that were like, yeah, if you need to get down and you're here, it's actually quite easy. I want you to be comfortable with it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so much meat in what we're talking about right here. So there's two things I want to say that may seem contradictory, but I want to give a fair shake to the people that would probably voice the other side of this also. But firstly, let me say that, yes, I think it does add value. All of those exercises, all of those maneuvers, I call it skill building. You know, it's like, you know, just like when you see a guy about to go up and hit in a baseball game, he's swinging with two bats, right? And that's just to make it feel heavier. So then when he goes up there and swings with one bat, it feels easy, you know, and that's, there is some of that. And so, like, for example, in our ground school app on the flight lesson side, I still include stall exercises, minimum controllable airspeed, coordination rolls, the lazy eight. None of those lessons are on the actual ACS. No one's going to go get tested on those things. But I put them in our app so that CFIs and students who are using our product around the country would know that this is stuff that I would show you. These are maneuvers, like you're saying, that I think have value, and that to the extent the CFI is comfortable, this is stuff that you should practice and it'll make you a better pilot. And where you draw that line is maybe what the other side of the table might say, is that this is an important line to recognize in training. And the reality is, the closer you get to the envelope without hurting anybody or anything, the better the training is. The problem with that is sometimes it becomes so dangerous that you introduce accidents in the training environment. Mm-hmm. An example that pops to my mind when I say that was just before COVID, I was touring around with the Air Safety Institute. I was doing the flight instructor renewal courses, and so I'd meet a lot of CFIs who'd been CFIs for a long time. One of them told a story about a guy at their local school who had a Citabria, and he would always make the student perform a forced landing, essentially. He would say, your engine failed, and when the student would do the carb heat and check the fuel and do everything they're supposed to do, he'd say, nope, didn't come back, still failed. What are you going to do? You know, and fold their arms, what are you going to do? And he would actually get them to cross that bridge in their mind and land the aircraft in a field. Now, and the quality of that training is undeniable. There's nobody that walked away from that experience who didn't learn something profound, right? The problem is, one day this particular instructor misjudged it or went to a different field or didn't see a power line and he killed himself and a student doing it. So we, as a professional group of flight instructors, have to figure out where that line is and what we're comfortable with. Yeah. And I know a lot of CFIs that walk that line and flirt with that line, especially, as I mentioned, in the Bay Area, where you have so many career flight instructors who are all very proficient and they fly every day and they know what the plane can do and they're out there showing people, and every now and again push it a little too close, you know. And
yeah,
they don't hurt, and they collapse the gear when they have a really hard landing in a Citabria or stuff like that, and or bend the prop, or, you know, this kind of stuff happens. And so it's a fine line we walk in training. Yeah. But I certainly think that the maneuvers we discussed here, the ones I mentioned in the app, you know, minimum controllable airspeed and stall exercises, assuming the CFI is comfortable, are really valuable.
That, I mean, that certainly makes a lot of sense. I couldn't agree more. You know, you can't go one direction, any direction too far and start compromising safety. And yet at the same time, there's certain thought processes or abilities that I just hope that we're spending enough time on. Another one I wanted to ask you about is the idea of the thought process that a pilot needs to have when something doesn't seem right, and how to get past that, how to, like, reduce that point, that delay factor, or find out how to solve something. This is something I think maybe all CFIs do, but certainly more CFI, more experienced CFIs know how to put something in there that's like, get someone to get comfortable with the process of something's not right.
Yeah.
You know, what do I do? That's a thought process, because I say that because that's a thought process that I feel like hurts a lot, kills a lot of pilots down the road, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think there's kind of two, just, you know, shooting from the hip here, sort of two things that come to mind right away. I mean, one is the sort of critical response items to an imminent crash, right? Like engine failure on takeoff, there's no time to think, what am I going to do here? Yeah. You know, it's like, for those, you better be ahead. And the way, you know, Richard, my mentor, used to make me do it, and I'm a little less strict about this, but sometimes I wonder if I should be, quite honestly. But he used to make me sit in the run-up and say, you know, we're the pre-takeoff briefing, you know, we're about to take off here from Oakland. At the time, it was runway 27 right, you know, and all the things I would say. And I would say, he would make me say, when the engine fails on the takeoff roll, we're going to just pull the mixture out, you know, and touch everything, pull the mixture out. We're going to slowly bring the airplane to a stop. We're going to shut the fuel off. We're going to turn off the mags. We're going to call the tower. We're going to turn off the master. If we get lucky and the airplane rotates at 55, we're going to leave the ground at 55. We're going to start to accelerate to 74. But when the engine fails at 200 feet, we're going to make sure the throttle's out. We're going to pitch forward. We're going to land straight ahead. You know, so he would literally make me do it, everything he could, to get my brain into the idea that this was truly the next minute and a half of my life. Like, welcome to your flight lesson. In the next 90 seconds, we're gonna crash this airplane back on the runway. Are you ready? What are you gonna touch? What are you gonna do, you know? And then make sure that I was that ready for it. And again, I had all my friends going, dude, he's milking you. How long was your run up? Your run up was 35 minutes. This old man's milking you. I heard that. I can't tell you how many times. Not true though. Definitely not true. He was not.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, what better way to do that? I think that's how I've always understood airline pilot training. You plan. This is exactly what's going to happen. You know, you're going to do these things.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I think the second thing that, you know, what you're talking about is, like, let's say it's en route, or there's something plaguing you, or you know, bugging you. There's a lot of things to think about there, but one thing I would think is, I always tell people, slow the airplane down first of all. And even if that means circle where you are, but just like, if things aren't right, it's like, it's not usually the good thing to just keep barreling off into some direction unless you're like on your way to some airport, is, you know. And I would think, take stock of what is working, you know, just aviate, navigate, communicate idea. Like, is the plane flying? Is the engine running? Do I have fuel? How bad could this really be? You know, and then, like, start to, you know, add it up. And then the last thing I guess I'll say is, you know, and I, this is always a tough one, because the one thing about training in California that you don't get as good as everybody else in the country is experience with weather, right? So right. I always worry about my little baby birds when they learn here to fly in California and then they go off to another state.
What are these cloud things?
Yeah, exactly.
What is
yeah.
that white stuff on the ground?
And the sky is falling. Something falling out of those clouds. So I always say to them, if you find yourself out there in the wild in another part of the country and you're just not entirely sure about something, you see a cloud in front of you, you don't know if it's safe to keep going, or it looks a little like sky's obscured or whatever it is, land the airplane at the first available opportunity and just go into the pilot's lounge, grab yourself a soda, maybe like a Snickers, you know, re-up on that, you know, blood sugar, and look at it again and then make a decision. And if the correct thing to do was to continue flying the airplane, it's easy enough to get back into it and continue flying. But in my experience, usually when your feet hit the pavement, there's a new level of clarity.
Yes.
The minute you leave the aircraft and put your feet on the pavement, you're like, well, I am feeling a little tired. I guess it's not a big deal if I don't make it there tonight. And there is a hotel a mile down the road, you know. You start thinking in a different way. So
makes sense. So tell me about the finer points. Tell me how you evolved into this and what it actually is for everybody to understand.
Yeah, it's again, I credit my students. Here I am, a CFI, former performer, living on a boat. I had a flip phone, 2005, and one of my students said to me one day, you should start a podcast. And I said, what's a podcast? And he said, I'll send you one. So he sent me NPR Stardate, I think. Does anyone listen to the NPR Stardate? And what it was is like a short little like 3 minute little informational tidbit about astronomy. Right. So it was like, you know, did you know that a quark was a bi? And it would just tell you this cool little thing about a quark. And I was like, I never knew that. So that was my first exposure to podcasts. And it didn't take much after that till I realized, wow, I could just make short little flight training tips, things that Richard has told me, things that I'm perfecting myself, like the finer points, and just get this information out to anybody. And they can actually like plug into it. And when I publish it, they get notified. I mean, this was all brand new. And that's how it started. The Finer Points Aviation Podcast was the first flight training podcast ever made.
Wow.
Yeah, October 14th, 2005. And the early episodes are very Stardate-like, you know, very short, composed. But yeah, then it evolved from there in the YouTube channel. And yeah. You crack up at some of my sponsorship conversations in 05, by the way. I went to Sun and Fun in 2006 with my new podcast, and every single director of marketing I ran into said, podcast? What's a podcast? I thought, man, I'm maybe a little early. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to take a while, but you now own the space. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it put us on the radar, you know, put us on the map, and ultimately it's a – that's what the business is. And if that's all you do is watch the YouTube videos and listen to the podcast, there's tons of stuff to learn. But ultimately, there's also a paid access app called Ground School.
So I want to show that because yeah. I love that.
Light side.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's myself and my co-founder Todd Eichel and now our partner Jacob Cross is also there's three of us on it sort of full time. We've got another group of about nine part-time people, CFIs mostly that help with the content. But it is really like taking lessons with me. So like the idea behind it is if you are taking lessons anywhere in the world really and you just want to know what it would be like to hop into California and take lessons with me. That's what the app is. Of course, there is ground training and written test prep and all of that. But I think where the app really excels is the finer points really at the end of the day. And it's not called that, it's called Ground School by the Finer Points. But there are, for example, in the instrument course, and there's two courses in there, but we do these things called scenarios where we'll fly an entire flight point to point. So it'll be, you know, the marine layer fog, it'll be 400 overcast and tops maybe 2,000 or 3,000. And we'll walk you through how we select the route and how we get the clearance and how we set up the radios. And it's all just divided into these nice little segments that bring you along and show you real world flights or higher level lessons if your CFI doesn't have much experience and you just want to see what. Like, you know, Jason's been doing this for 2 decades. I wonder what he would do with me if I went to California. It's like, it's in the app.
One of the things I want to emphasize about what I've seen so far in it is that it's to me as an outsider, as a newbie, it is almost a misnomer of like being ground school, right? Because I think a lot of pilots who already have their tickets or have an advanced ticket, like an IFR or a commercial, think of ground school as like, I think I remember that from 15 years ago. I mean, you know, but that's not what this is. This is so much more because this is, like you said, scenario-based training for existing pilots also, for advanced pilots to keep brushing up on your skills. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's both things. So if you're coming into it brand new, of course, it has everything you need. But I also really feel like when I go out and lecture, when I talk to pilots about safety, and I do it a lot at this point in my career, most of my talks are about safety. And what we really talk about is emulating professionals. You know, the pros do it really well. Like there's a reason you're not afraid to get on an American Airlines flight for the most part, you know, or a United flight. And there's a reason you should be a little skeptical about, you know, some dude named Rick that has an old 170 and you've never met him before. You know, it's like the airlines are doing something right. So what is that? And we model that in the app. And one of the things they do is they go back for recurrent training. So we invented this concept of knowledge recall where the app keeps track and says like, hey, it's been like 100 days since you've looked at your standard operating procedures. Maybe you should brush up on those. And it'll like offer you a short quiz and you can charge up your knowledge. And we keep track of You know, you can see it graphically depicted. I think if I show you my version, because I've been going through it, you can see some of these circles are are orange, some of them are green. I don't know if you can see that. But yeah. The orange ones are telling me I need to brush up. You know, so yeah. We're trying to create a product that has like this ongoing engagement. And mm-hmm. even when you finish the course, like we said, we're releasing scenarios. So we work with YouTube partners like Flight Chops and SoCal Flying Monkey and Blanco Lirio, and sometimes just our own stuff. But we'll see what's happening to people out there in the wild. You know, like SoCal Flying Monkey flies up to the gorge every year. One year he encountered a layer of smoke and didn't know what to do with it. So we'll break that apart like a lesson. We'll say, let's talk to Eric about that. Let's see what the information was that he was looking at. What decision would you have made? And then that becomes a scenario in the app. And we're always looking for ways to help pilots emulate that airline model more. Mm-hmm. How do we keep you in a sort of ongoing engaged with I don't want to say training, but engaged with proficiency in an ongoing way after your training?
No, that really makes sense. And you do something else in it that I want to point out, and that is you get into specifics. A lot of programs are incredibly generic, and yet as a pilot, you can't be generic. You need to be specific with your aircraft, your V-speeds, your numbers, your everything. And you don't stay generic. You teach people how to be specific. It's maybe not the aircraft that they're going to fly, but it's an example of how to be specific. Tell me more.
Yeah, that was a tough. That's a conscious choice and a somewhat tough choice. Although I think people get it for the most part. But yeah, you look at other training programs, or I did, and they'll talk about an electrical system, and they'll say, "What's a primary bus?" or "What's a master switch?" or "What's a," and it's hard to prep somebody for an oral if you don't really know. Are they flying an airplane with a 24-volt system or a 14-volt system, or does it have a generator or an alternator? So we realized pretty early on that we wanted to plant a flag and say, we're going to use a Cessna 172S for this course. We're going to give you the POH, and we're going to teach you the level of depth you're going to need to know any airplane to succeed in this world. Now, we gambled on the 172S because, of course, most people are training in a 172S. But even if you're not, it kind of doesn't matter, really, because we're able, for example, like we just, a support ticket came in this morning where some guy, the question on an oral was, in our oral, we have this, or in our product, we've got this oral simulator. And I don't know if you've seen it, but we've developed this ability to chain questions together so that we can kind of create a conversational tone. We can say, like, tell me about the engine on your aircraft. And then the next question can be, does it have a fuel pump, or how many fuel pumps does it have? We don't have to reestablish the context,
Right, right.
They're all chained. And that was the question. It was, how many fuel pumps does your engine have on this aircraft? And the guy complained and wrote in a support ticket and said, how could I possibly answer this? I don't know what airplane you're talking about. And he was obviously new to the app, and he jumped right into that oral section. So we kind of had to explain to him that we could never ask you a question like that if we didn't commit to the plane. And what we're trying to show you is a question like that is totally fair game on your oral.
Yes.
Right? Like, so what I want him walking away knowing is the examiner might ask him on his oral, how many fuel pumps are on your airplane? That's the most important part. We're trying to show the level of depth that you have to go to.
Right.
And then
right.
I honestly do believe there's a value in learning a plane through and through. It's almost like a skill in itself, like a micro skill. How do you learn an airplane?
Mm-hmm. It makes sense because, like you said, that's what you're going to get hit with. You're going to get hit with a lot more specific because during your oral, when you're there with an examiner, it's going to not just be this aircraft. It's going to be questions about this exact aircraft that you're about to go up in.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so that, we definitely, now in the instrument course, we had to choose two airplanes because we wanted one. So we do the 172S that we use on the private course because everybody knows that. And then we introduced the G1000 system with the GFC 700 autopilot.
Yep.
So once we've taught you those two planes, or really just the addition of the avionics, the G1000 avionics suite and the new autopilot, then when we publish a scenario, it could be either one. So some month we might show you, here's what it looks like to fly point to point from Monterey to San Carlos in the G1000 with an RNAV approach at the end, GPS approach at the end. And then in another month, it might be, here's what it looks like to fly from Modesto to Santa Rosa in the standard panel airplane and just fly an ILS. You know, and the idea is we want people to be kind of ambidextrous, or at least understand what's happening in both.
Got it. That's very cool. I really like that you're doing that. I want to dive in into at least one real kind of like hot topic. And it seems like right now there are a few things blowing up the internet when it comes to general aviation more than pattern entries. This is the thing of the day that is kind of blowing everything up. And one of the topics, my good friend Brian Schiff has also been talking about it. You've been talking about it. Everyone's going crazy about it. Tell me about kind of what's going on with pattern entries and this thing that people are debating about, teardrop entries. Why on earth is this the hot thing?
I think the short answer to that question is probably ForeFlight, to be honest, is just because they call it a teardrop and they have such a large number of users, and it made a lot of sense for them. Like, I don't mean to blame them entirely. Okay, so let me just, this is the public show.
No, but if they're going to draw entries, right? Like, all sorts of products.
Imagine you're them, right? You have to end the route somehow, right? Uh-huh. You have to, that pink line has to end at the airport in some fashion. So some engineer said, well, we should put them on the 45 to the downwind here. So we should hit the point and then we should fly out and make, oh, look at that. The FAA makes this shape. Let's just do that shape. Hey, that kind of looks like a teardrop. Let's call that a teardrop. And they decided to call it a teardrop. Nobody before them called it a teardrop. The FAA didn't call it a teardrop. Nobody else has called it a teardrop. They call it a teardrop. So many people are out there using it. They're just tapping this teardrop thing. It becomes part of what my friend calls the tribal knowledge of aviation. It becomes part of the vernacular of CFIs across the country. And it never hit my radar. It started, you know, I think Brian Schiff was the first one day said to me, have you seen people doing this thing? It's like kind of a new thing. Like, this was somewhere in like, when did this like 2012, 2013, something like that. So it's the last 10, 11 years. It's like starting to percolate its way through the national airspace system. And I fly at towered airports mostly. So I was like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard that before. I never heard teardrop, right? It was always enter on the 45.
No, the only teardrop is an IFR hold entry, right? That's the only legal term.
Unfortunately, that's the way this industry works. It got lodged in the minds, and it got, you know, enough people hear it on the radio, enough people are tapping it on their iPad that they think, you know, it should be called a teardrop. And my point in the videos that I made, and I was a tough series. I had some really great CFI quit me this morning. I don't know who he was. All he did was send in a support ticket. He had more letters behind his name than I've ever seen before. He was in the CFI and everything under the sun. And he basically just said, everything you said is rubbish. Delete me from your contact list. Like, you know, that's it. He's done with me. He quit me, period.
You got canceled. I think
he accused me of not having enough experience first. Then he quit, right? So, this is, you know, look,
tell me, what's your opinion on that entry? What's the bottom line for you? And to be clear for everybody, right? You're talking about coming in, going out on a 45, basically, and then reversing course.
Well, my issue with the word teardrop is that there are at least three different pictures that people paint in their mind when you say that. And I was able to demonstrate that in the video series through the comments. The people yelling at me, it was great. They were yelling at me, but they were yelling and they didn't realize that they were actually proving the case, right? So when you say I'm teardropping on the radio or teardropping into the 45 or teardropping into the downwind, those are all different shapes, different positions in space. So really my point is the emphasis should be on the 45. ForeFlight, if you're listening, you just need to retitle this the 45 entry. Okay. So it's either, you know, it's not a teardrop, it's a 45 entry. And just maybe have the line, like do what Garmin does, have the line end at the airport and just start a new line out there on the 45. Like let the pilot figure out how they're going to get out there. But what I'd prefer to hear on the radio and what we've always heard on the radio before this started creeping into the sort of language of everything is just tell me where you are. I'm 2 miles north of the field maneuvering to enter on the 45, you know, or 2 miles northwest of the field or 4 miles north of the field. One of the CFIs, we have a thing called a CFI club, and it's free for anybody that cares to show up. It's like a once a month Zoom call and everyone gets free access to our app. But on the last Zoom call, one of the CFIs in the room gave us a huge gift. He said, He was an agreeer. There's agreeers and disagreeers. And by the way, one of the commenters who was yelling at me ended up on the CFI Club call. So he was like, I was that guy. But anyway, the gift we got was this CFI told us that the language he uses is you overfly the field and then you leave the area and then you enter the pattern. And that's my point. That we need, as instructors, we need to make a break from it's not this beautiful sweeping shape that ForeFlight drew or some picture you have in your mind. Because depending on how you cross the runway, whether you cross it perpendicular and teardrop into the 45, or you cross it on an angle and teardrop into the downwind, or you cross it this way, then jog to the left a little bit and teardrop right back down into a midfield. Like, these are all examples of people describing this thing. I know exactly what we're doing. They're doing this. And they're all saying different things, right? Just breaking away from that language. It's get out on the 45, be clear about how you're getting out there, and it's a 45 degree entry.
That makes sense. And so let me just wrap this one up with a quick kind of hit you with a couple things and have you give me right or wrong.
Okay.
So I'm old school. I was taught if you are on the side of the pattern, meaning like left pattern, you know, you're on that side, well, then you just bring yourself into a 45. Like, that's your goal. If you're on that side, the pattern side of the runway, pattern side of the airport. If you're on the opposite side, you can either do a midfield left crosswind entry, let's say, assuming, and I'm really saying, assuming that you're not cutting anyone off, that there's not a lot of extra stuff going on there. Or if there's a bunch of people, then you're entering a upwind and then working your way in through that left pattern, essentially. Right or wrong? Is there something wrong with that?
Well, no. I mean, like, I was in agreement with everything you said, right up to the upwind part. I wasn't totally clear on that, but just so you can.
I guess all I was saying is, like, if something was busy, I was always taught you don't do that midfield left crosswind. You go down and you're entering down like where the other people are coming. They're coming up on a 45, and you're coming from essentially a crosswind.
Right.
That's all I meant.
Yeah, and what these people are saying are the people that are. Not, you know, that are quitting me or whatever for saying this. They're basically saying that you fly over the pattern when you come from the wrong side or from the dead side. You fly over the pattern until you're 2 miles clear of the airport, and then you make a teardrop turn onto the 45.
Okay, that's why I gave you the yes or no or right or wrong, is if you don't do that and you do what I was taught, is that
Hey, look, this is the thing that I want. I mean, I don't, like, you know, some guy wrote in and he said, look, my plane's too fast. That works for me every time I cross midfield. I'm always perfectly perpendicular and I teardrop back into the 45. It's like, great. If you do that, that's fine. But don't call it a teardrop on the radio, because it's like when you're in a turn and ATC goes, you have traffic at 5 o'clock. It's like, that doesn't tell me anything, right? And if you tell me you're teardropping into something, like, I don't trust you. I just had a comment war with thousands of people, all of whom have different ideas of what a teardrop is, where it ends, where it begins, what it means. Just tell me where you are, you know, and get on that 45.
It reminds me, you know what it sounds like to me? I think it was last summer, I was over flying into Griffiths, New York, and which is a towered airport there. And someone called into the airport saying that they were 3 miles left of the airport, to the left. And the controller kept trying to clarify, and they kept saying, like, what don't you understand? I'm 3 miles left of the airport. And so, exactly, you're not doing anybody any favors.
You can't make this stuff up, man.
Exactly. All right. Well, listen, Jason, we are at the time of the show. I would like to do Social Flight's Fast Five before we wrap up our program with you tonight. So how do you feel about that?
I love it. Let's do it. You can't. Excellent. There's no wrong answers in the Fast Five, are there?
No. Well, we're about to find out.
Right.
Jason Miller, this is your Social Flights Fast Five. Five questions for people to get to know who you are. Jason Miller with the finer points. So, are you ready?
Yes, I think.
Okay. Question number one. You have flown a lot of different aircraft during your more than 20 years of flight instruction and so many other things. Is there one either type or plane in particular? Is there something that is closest to your heart in all that time?
Yeah, like an 85 Mooney. And not the later ones either, like something about the early 80s Moonies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's
What's
hard
the
to
reason. Describe. What is it about that?
I don't know. It's a difficult question to answer, but I know that every time I get in one, and I have a student that owns one right now, so I'm in it every Thursday morning. And every time I get in one, I think to myself, man, I love this plane.
Like, you just like being snuggled up with someone else. Is that what it is?
It's what?
It's like being really snuggled up with someone else.
Yeah, it's everything's right. Like the where you put your hands and rest your hands, the way it flies, the way it handles, the harmony between the controls, the way the pedals feel, the way it just like pretty much everything about it. And I've flown the later models, like the Ovation and the Acclaim, and I didn't have the same feeling. I mean, I like those. They're a lot faster. I mean, they're
that's awesome.
There's like some sort of a resonance sweet spot there, like somewhere, but I don't know, 83, 84, 85 movies.
Love it. Excellent. All right. Question number two. Can you think back on either a scary or impactful moment of flying that somehow changed your view, something that you learned something from?
Yeah, I mean, there's two of them that jump to mind. Both of them are continued VFR into IMC, and they stand out in my mind because continued VFR into IMC kills more people than all other weather accidents combined, and I was experienced when this caught me. But one time, I was angry. I was I didn't know how upset I was about something, and I was with my family, and we ended up executing a leg of a flight that I probably shouldn't have, and found myself in deteriorating weather 6 minutes from my destination, but wishing I wasn't in that situation. You know what I mean? When you're looking at the GPS. And you're like, I'm going to be where I need to go in 6 minutes, but I'd rather not be here right now. We should have stayed. You made the wrong choice, you know?
That makes sense.
And there was another time, again, with a student when I'm a double eye. I'm perfectly comfortable in the clouds. But a student and I were trying to find our way through a hole, and we ended up in IMC. And it was an embarrassing, awful experience. But, you know, so both of those experiences, I feel like you come to know yourself a little bit if you've been doing this long enough. And I definitely have a anti-authority voice that's prevalent in my mind. I have to like really catch the red flags and rein myself in.
Got it. All right. Question number three. If you could briefly go back to any time in your life, not to change things, just to, let's say 15 minutes, you get to go back and re-experience something because it was truly special for you, what would that moment be?
It's a really good one. I think it would be my instrument check ride with Lou Fields, you know, the guy that I was telling you about, the Corsair instructor. I didn't get enough of Lou. You know, when I met him, I think he was already 85. He lived to be in 93 or something like that, 92. But what a special man. And if I had a chance to spend any more time with Lou, I probably would have done that. So my instrument check ride was a great day. I got the whole day with Lou.
Wonderful. All right. Yeah. Question number four, if you could go back and give some words of advice to your younger self from your either your teens, 20s, whenever you want to go back to, what would you tell your younger self?
At the 5-year mark, don't quit. The theme of my life, Jeff, has been I'm a little too early to think. Like with the band, for example, not that I want to be a musician, but had we hung in there for another 3 or 4 years, it would have been a whole different situation. You know, wow. We were a little early. We were 3 years before Dave Matthews, 3 years before Fish. You know, we just needed to hang in there a little longer. And the same with like the podcasting and YouTube. I mean, I started the podcast in 2005 and the YouTube in 2007. So right around 2011 and 12, I was in a pretty stiff burnout. You know, that was a lull for me, but that's when the world discovered YouTube, 2012, you know? So again, it's just a little too early. So I think about that a lot, and I am I don't know what the right word is, but I really force myself in my later life to just follow through with everything and have faith that staying
that the world will catch up to you.
Yeah. Just staying true to it and not doubting, especially in the fifth year.
All right. Well, our last question on Social Flight's Fast Five. Question number five. If you could choose anyone alive or no longer with us anywhere in the world, anywhere in history or present to spend an evening with, to get an opportunity to be with, who would that be?
Wow. I think Amelia Earhart is up there. You know, I think about her last flight a lot, and I don't know if it's because she left from Oakland, you know, and I spent so much time there, and that picture of her flying over the Bay Bridge when the Golden Gate was being built, and like, it's just this classic time. But her fate seemed so certain. Mm. It's like, what motivates you? You know, that's a lonely, it's romantic. We all think about it, but for the, like even describing a moment like being in the clouds, wishing you weren't there, you know, or I was talking to JP Schultz, the Candorist at Oshkosh, about flying around the world. And, you know, when you're really up against nature and the elements in a machine and you're not sure you're going to make it out, it's like one of the loneliest feelings on Earth. You know, you're not even on Earth anymore. You're connected to nothing, to nobody. You're in a flying machine somewhere between Earth and God. It's lonely. So just knowing what really lit her up and motivated her, and she would certainly be like, I guess, one of the pilots I'd want to talk to.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, Jason, thank you so, so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live. I am grateful for your friendship, everything you do to support general aviation and keep educating pilots in such wonderful ways and helping us all along the journey. The app, of course, the TFP Ground School, the Finer Points, the podcast of the Finer Points. Everyone should go out there and check that out. And again, I really appreciate you coming on this evening and helping us with our debate opener here on Social Flight Live.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate it. And I just want to say, I love what you guys are doing. I think, you know, pilots need a mission, and the fact that people can get their certificate and rather than just burning out and you know, or going to buy a couple hamburgers and being done with it after how many bay tours, you give them places to go, curated photos. It's pretty amazing. So I've been watching you. I know you're an old timer like me. We've been at this a long time. So congrats on everything you do. And thank you. I'm really honored to be here, and I'd love to do it again sometime. So thank you.
Absolutely. Would love to have you. Jason Miller, The Finer Points. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, Jeff. You too.
All right. Take care.
See ya.
And thanks to all of you for everything that you do to support general aviation and for joining us here tonight on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday evening, that's September 17th, with a bit of a surprise as far as what our guest is going to be. We have a couple things going on. Kenny G would like to join us for Tuesday night. He is in the middle of a book tour promoting something that he's got that is truly amazing. He's going to try, but we are not sure yet if he's going to have to do that or reschedule. And we also have Jolie Lucas on deck coming in, who is, oh my God, so fantastic. She has a date that she's coming on the show for sure, and has also said that she'd step in and do some improv here for Kenny if his book tour takes him away from that. And then on September 24th, the week after that, Teresa Claiborne, the first female African-American pilot in the United States Air Force, will be joining us. I know Teresa very well. She is an amazing individual, one of the most accomplished, fantastic people, truly spectacular, and someone that you're really going to want to meet. And then on Tuesday, October 1st, Jimmy Graham from the NFL, the former tight end of the NFL and pilot and chair of EAA's Young Eagles, will be joining us here on Social Flight Live. Until next time, thank you so much for joining us here, and I wish you all blue skies.